Security Ledger podcasts reach an audience of thousands of information technology and information security professionals. If that's an audience that you'd like to reach, think about becoming a Security Ledger podcast sponsor. To find out more about sponsoring our podcast, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sales. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. In this episode of the podcast, number 165.
From coast to coast to coast, tonight, Canadians rejected division and negativity.
As Canada's young, handsome Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, charged over the finish line to victory in national elections this week, the U.S.'s neighbor to the north seemed on track to retain its reputation as a redoubt of polite progressivism in North America. But for independent security researchers, Canada's reputation as a welcoming and friendly society may ring hollow. In fact, an absence of clear legal precedents is making Canada a pretty cold place for independent security researchers, just as their skills are becoming critical. In this episode of the podcast, we're joined by Tamir Israel, a staff attorney at the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic, or CIPIC. Israel's among the attorneys who are often called on to defend the work of independent security researchers in Canada. But first, if you want to understand how chilly it can be up north for independent security researchers, consider the experience of Noah Clements. The 19-year-old undergraduate at the University of New Brunswick took the opportunity to dig into the workings of a smart doorbell that his parents had purchased for their home. Noah's surprising discoveries led to a months-long odyssey with the doorbell's maker, the Canadian firm D-Bell, and its attorneys, which included everything from charges of extortion to threats of legal action.
My name is Noah Clements. I'm 19 years old. I am currently a second-year computer science student at the University of New Brunswick.
And so we're talking to you, Noah, because you found a pretty interesting vulnerability in a smart doorbell system from a company called D-Bell. It's actually a Canadian company. Reported it and got, I note, CVE-13336. You were just one off.
Yeah, I know. I did notice that.
You didn't have one you could burn and then get 13337 for this?
I probably could have tried if I wanted to.
So close. So I guess first order of business is tell us just a little bit about this vulnerability that you found, or I guess it's really more than one, with D-Bell, and maybe start by just talking a little bit about what D-Bell is.
So D-Bell is I guess it's short for doorbell.
We can only assume.
Yeah, they mainly focus on doorbell products, and my parents bought this doorbell probably 3-4 years ago, and we never really installed it. One day, I was just kind of bored at home and decided to look into it, I guess. It took me about an hour. I was going through the source code on the web server that I found. I just noticed that there was a lot of commented out URL templates, and so I just kind of fooled around with those with many of the JavaScript functions that they had in there. And I just found out that you could unlock a doorbell, or unlock the door lock, I guess, if it's connected to the doorbell.
So what model D-Bell were you looking at?
They explained that it was the first generation D-Bell doorbell. Specifically, I think it was the DB01S doorbell.
Okay. Parents are early adopters of smart home technology, I guess?
Yeah, apparently. I don't know how they found this doorbell, to be honest. I try and stay away from IoT smart devices as much as I can.
Yeah.
I've pretty much barred them from buying any Google Homes or Amazon Echoes in the house.
One of the things that this doorbell allows you to do, I guess, is to actually connect to a door lock. Obviously, this would be a electronic door lock, not a physical door lock. And unlock it via a command sent to the doorbell. And you figured out that pretty much anybody who at least knew about this particular vulnerability could do this without needing a username or password or anything.
I kind of stumbled upon not needing a username or password accidentally.
So first of all, how did you get access to the source code for the doorbell itself? Because this is an issue that I think a lot of smart home device makers are not super aware of the fact that there are users like you out there who are knowledgeable enough to be able to do this. But how did you do it?
So on the back of this doorbell, there was a default username and password. I think it might have been admin, and I think the password was just blank. So I just did a basic nmap scan to see what ports were open and noticed that there was a web server. So I went onto the web server and it asked me for username and password. So I just used the one from the back of the doorbell. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it just gave me all of the source code. I could just inspect everything from there.
And presumably that would have been used to configure the doorbell as a owner of it, as a consumer. You would need to connect to that web server to set up the doorbell on your network. Is that the idea?
My guess is that with the mobile app, it uses that web server to launch the commands.
So ordinarily for a user, you would be configuring it via your mobile app.
Yeah.
So that web server wasn't necessarily there for users to be able to access.
I don't think it was, no.
Right. Which we can tell because, of course, once you were into that web application server, there were all kinds of interesting stuff that you discovered.
Yeah.
So these commented out features had been part of the source code, then they're still there, but they're commented out, which means they're not executed. But what did you find and what were you able to do to be able to ultimately open this thing just with a command and without any authentication?
The one that I was mostly focusing on, there was a commented out piece of code that had a URL and then had plus CGI URL. And then beside it had potentially a default admin password. The CGI URL part kind of piqued my interest because there was all the functions were .cgi on the web server.
Right.
So I was just kind of fooling around with what if I put, you know, restart.cgi in this URL. Would it restart the doorbell? And so that's where I kind of started.
And it did.
Yeah.
So you could just basically send any function to this again without authenticating and getting it to do what you wanted to
do. Yeah. So I originally started with the given username and password that I had in the commented out URL. And then accidentally I forgot to type in the password. And then it's still executed. So that was pretty funny.
And you figured out you actually didn't even need a username either.
No, yeah, you could put absolutely whatever you want in it.
Of course, opening a door would be kind of the worst case scenario of what you could do. That's, allow physical access to the house. But a lot of, I'm guessing, sort of nuisance attacks you could launch as well, like ringing a doorbell constantly or something like that. Full disclosure, you would need to be on the same wireless network as a doorbell in order to access this. Is that right?
That would be probably the most likely term or the most likely outcome is you would need to connect to the Wi-Fi network and then use this exploit. But if this port was potentially open, maybe like port forwarded, then there could be a possibility that you could do this
from outside.
From outside, yeah.
Right. If it was port forwarded because you wanted to be able to access it from outside the home, right? With a doorbell, there's a good use case for wanting to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You reported this publicly and got a CVE for it. Have you contacted D-Bell at all about this?
So I did initially contact them first when I found this vulnerability, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty happy about me reporting it, and they thanked me for it. They were releasing a new doorbell in, like, I think 2 months from when I initially contacted them, and they offered to split the cost in half and have me penetration test that device.
Like, give you a device for half off and then let you do pen testing on it?
Yeah.
Wow, that's generous.
Yeah. I emailed them back explaining that because this thing was... it ended in 2016. They just stopped releasing them in 2016.
This particular model that your parents had.
Yeah. So I asked them if I just could disclose this earlier than 90 days because it's been canceled for that long. And then that's when they came back with a very hostile email explaining that I was being malicious.
The old, how dare you find the security vulnerabilities in our product?
Yep.
And then you haven't heard anything back from them since?
There was a couple emails going back and forth. And the final one from them was explaining that it would be forwarded to their legal team if I didn't stop in 10 days. And they will file a case for extortion with the local police before taking legal action. And then that's when I contacted the EFF, which then sent me to the CIPPIC in Canada.
Okay.
And that's where Tamir helped me out. He sent an email to them a couple of weeks later explaining that there was no legal grounds for suing me.
And have you heard from them since?
No, I have not.
I mean, this is an end-of-life product. It was end-of-life, I think you said, in 2016.
Correct.
Do we know how many of these are out there in the sitting on the fronts of people's homes?
I have no idea.
And do we know that, first of all, that they've addressed this issue in the existing code for the existing products, and obviously that they've addressed it for the products that they're releasing now?
I have no idea. I mean, I'd have to buy one, but I don't really want to give them my money.
Well, you can have one for half off if you just want to donate your incredibly valuable pen testing time to them at the equivalent of like $8 an hour.
Yeah.
And they gave you no indication of whether they had addressed this issue or whether the issue you raised might also exist in their subsequent products?
No, they gave me no information on that.
Well, is it your sense that they were coding this themselves, or maybe that they just kind of copied and pasted code from an open source web server or something like that?
I think this was not specifically their product, because I did notice in the source code that there were some Chinese letters on there. So I don't think it's directly their product, and this could be
an OE, a white label, or an OEM from somebody else. Very cool. Okay, so are you you're going to keep up with this IoT hacking thing? I think there's a bright future for you if you choose to do it.
I would love to. Right now, I don't have much money as a student to buy all these products. But if something comes into my hands, I'll definitely test it out.
Noah Clements, University of New Brunswick, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Noah Clements is a student at the University of New Brunswick. He was here to talk with us about his research on the D-Bell smart doorbell. Up next, it's a common refrain that there are more similarities than differences between Canada and the United States, two countries that share a centuries-old friendship and the longest open border in the world. But when it comes to protecting the work of independent security researchers, Canada is lagging behind its neighbor to the south, says our next guest, Tamir Israel of the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic. In this interview, Tamir and I talk about the challenges faced by security researchers in Canada and how an absence of clear interpretations of existing laws is creating doubts about the legality of their work.
So my name is Tamir Israel. I'm staff lawyer at the Samuelson Glasgow Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic, CIPIC for short, at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law. So CIPIC is a public interest technology law clinic. We do a range of things with the overall objective of advocating in the public interest on matters that arise at the intersection of law and technology. The type of work that we do can range from strategic intervention in the courts to testifying before Parliament on various technology-related legal initiatives, to representing individuals who are facing legal threats for doing things that are important for the public interest on the internet and in terms of security and in other contexts.
So on this podcast, obviously, we've tended to focus more on information security policy, law and policy in the lower 48 states rather than up there in the Great White North. But for our listeners, talk a little bit about what the state of play is up there in Canada with regard to the work of independent security researchers, either on IoT devices or other types of, connected devices.
So on the one hand, we do have a very engaged information security community up in Canada, which is great. On the other hand, it's regrettably the case that often when security researchers and information security researchers in Canada do the work that they're doing and find and uncover securities and try to get them fixed in a responsible way, they do face very aggressive legal threats. And part of the challenge in Canada in particular is that while we have the same sort of toolkit of protections for anti-intrusion protections that you would have in the state, many of them have not been interpreted in the courts. So there's a lack of clarity, which gives companies and government bodies a lot of leeway to really push back on security researchers in ways that's hard for them to respond to often. So I would say this creates a bit of a chilling effect for security researchers up here and undermines the important work that they could be doing more of, I guess, is really the best way to put it.
Could you give us an example of maybe some ideas that have been enshrined in law but not really interpreted by the courts? And so there's still sort of open questions that create, as you said, ambiguity or uncertainty?
Sure. So there's a criminal code provision that's very similar to the CFAA mechanisms in the U.S., which basically says, you know, no unauthorized access to a computer system. Whereas in the U.S., we've had a lot of court interpretation of this that has said, you know, this doesn't apply in the context where, you know, you can't go after someone just for violating a terms of use condition. There has to be like more rigorous intrusion, or you have to have some sort of malicious intent before you could really go after them with full force of law. Here, it hasn't really been interpreted. We had one case where this individual basically found a bunch of PDFs with a lot of really sensitive information on a government website and tried to get them to take it down, and then posted the link to this to these live PDFs that were exposed on this government website just to draw attention to it. And they're basically this person has been charged with criminal charges, you know, and in the press they were exposed as a hacker for finding this folder of exposed PDFs and then eventually posting the hyperlink on a Facebook group to draw attention to the fact that this data was exposed.
Right. Really just pointing out the fact that it's publicly accessible.
Right.
Where is public sentiment at, if you can gauge that type of thing? What is your sense about how well the laws, or at least the enforcement of the laws, aligns with public sentiment? Are people up there think charitably about the work of independent security researchers, or are they kind of suspicious?
Honestly, I think it goes case by case, right? So, and the narrative shifts based on who's telling it, right? So there was another example of a student basically in university in Nova Scotia, one of the provinces here, and he found a trove of Freedom of Information requests that had been not made public, but kept on a server of the government. And he found them and he made them public. And again, he was charged, you know, with criminal charges. And for like a month, the charges were in place. And the initial messaging from the government was, you know, hacker, you know, breaches our network, blah, blah, like, and it was that type of framing. And so initially, there was a bit of hostility. Over time, though, there was the narrative changed. The press kind of got the other side of the story, understood that these were already publicly exposed documents. This researcher was only exposing to the government a breach of security that was already there. And then the narrative did change. And eventually, in that instance, the charges were dropped because of the public reaction. We had other ones as well, though, that just remained secret. But a lot of the problem, too, is that when security researchers are facing this type of scrutiny, often what you see is actually like flaws found within, you know, internal infrastructures of companies or universities or other types of institutions as well, where they can't even go to the public and they're just left in that, you know, internal trap, and it's really hard to push back sometimes.
So we're speaking today because of a case that came to my attention about a undergraduate, actually, in New Brunswick there, who discovered a pretty interesting security flaw, and by interesting, I mean serious, upsetting, potentially dangerous, in a internet-connected doorbell from company D-Bell, which I think is a Canadian company. And reported it and got the kind of standard angry lawyer response that I hear from many security researchers, which is the assumption that the company makes that this is some kind of a shakedown or an extortion attempt against them, when, again, the researcher is really just trying to call a problem to their attention. I know you were involved on the researcher's behalf, but how common are incidents like that? How often do they come across your desk?
So I would say we get like maybe on average one a month in general of security researchers who found legitimate flaws, just try to really bring them to the company's attention. Usually they're acting in a fairly responsible manner, as was the case here, where the researcher acted in 100% a responsible manner. In some cases, it might be, you know, the level of whether they're acting in a fully responsible manner is a bit blurry, but in part that's just because there's no real clear guidelines on that, but we can talk about that in a sec. But regrettably common, the immediate reaction is almost always just hostility, and there's not necessarily a need for it, right? I mean, this could be a collaborative thing, especially in this instance with D-Bell, right? It's a product that's a bit older, right? So this flaw is not a live flaw per se. I mean, it's still important to have these flaws exposed, and whether someone's using the device or not, it's just, you know, important from a, you know, public reporting perspective. But I think part of the problem is just it's almost like a education problem. Like if companies were more accustomed or had more modeling as to how to deal positively with security researchers, or we've talked in the past about trying to push vulnerability disclosure policy that has some sort of safe harbor built into it as best practice. Like these kinds of things I think would help a lot with that. But often the immediate reaction is always just, you know, just make legal threats and hopefully that'll solve it.
It is surprising because, you know, at this point, this late date, 2019, there are companies that actually their whole business is just setting up bug bounty programs on behalf of other companies and sort of mediating this whole relationship between the researcher and the company. And obviously those companies, even if they don't take you on as a customer, are more than happy to tell you what a good and responsible vulnerability disclosure policy looks like.
Absolutely. And there's been a couple attempts in the past year as well to make Canadian specific ones that aren't dramatically different from the ones you would have like internationally or in the US. But even because they're slightly catered to the Canadian ecosystem, at least that, you know, maybe is a bit of signaling to Canadian companies to start paying attention. But I think also part of it is just that part of the discussion hasn't been as integrated into security and technical innovation discussions here. So at like the tech conferences, there's less people talking about vulnerable, like, you know, VDPs and safe harbors and that kind of thing. So I think that trying to flag it in our own messaging to the extent that we have a platform for these kinds of things. But I think more could be done.
When you guys get involved in incidents like this, and we talk about DBell or others, is it typically reaction of the company that they back off and that they sort of, you know, see, you know, you're able to set them straight or not? In other words, do they kind of figure out that there's a better way to be doing this and threatening the researcher, or do they dig in?
So in this case, they did back off, and that's good. And but I would say that there's a couple of problematic factors here, right? So I would say like overall it's 50-50 on that front, but there are a couple of complicated factors. So first of all, because there's less of a part of the what helped this resolve so rapidly, I think, was that the researcher was, you know, as responsible as you can really imagine. It was almost like a perfect, because this is a product that was, you know, they owned, it was in their house. There was no like network intrusion, no bypassing of, you know, DRMs or anything. The disclosure, he went to the company and gave them plenty of notice. The product's a bit old, so it's not even live. To the extent that it's live,
yeah,
there may be a few out there, but I mean, there's not a high risk of intrusion, right? This is a relatively easy case to get them to back down. But because there isn't a lot of standardization around what a responsible disclosure and intrusion detection approach is, on the one hand, and not really a lot of public kind of authoritative sources that say, like, if you go through these steps, you're fine. I think it makes the negotiations really difficult. So like I can go in and say this person acted responsibly and try to point to things like the established bug bounty programs that you're talking about that have these things documented and try to convince someone in a company or at a public institution or whatever that the researcher followed the proper steps and did the proper thing if they did. But if they don't have that experience if it's something that seems completely new to them that they haven't really dealt with before, it doesn't always resonate as much. And then beyond that as well, because there isn't as many clear-cut guidelines, a lot of security researchers, when they're just digging around their own, don't necessarily conform. So that's also a challenge. Doesn't necessarily mean that leads to the type of harm that you actually do want to be preventing, per se, but just that they didn't necessarily know that they had to, you know, what bounds to stay within when they were going through their process. And that also makes things very difficult and makes it very difficult to convince a company or institution to back down on its own initiative, right?
Yeah.
And then the default then is the researcher needs to decide, you know, assuming they're not already being charged with something, which is the tougher case, but decide, do I go ahead and risk, you know, charges or whatever, or do I just drop it? And unfortunately, there's been a few instances where they've just dropped it. And in some of them, the vulnerabilities did not even get fixed. So
that is the thing, is often the issues aren't fixed. They look at it as sort of a public relations issue, not necessarily a product reliability issue that they need to address. You know, it's like, how do we just make this go away?
Or they fix it partially or whatever it is, right? Like,
yeah.
They fix it, they do put some Band-Aid on it.
Yeah. Obviously, with the Internet of Things, I mean, this is was a connected doorbell, but it was also one that could be used to interact with a connected lock, door lock. So there was this sort of scenario in which being able to hack the doorbell would have been able to allow you to open the door. There's just so much proliferation of these smart home products. It's a big new category of product. It's a little bit dispiriting to me that a, you know, 20-year-old college kid kind of home on break can spend a couple hours kicking around with one and find a really serious security hole.
It's incredibly concerning, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like the bodies are kind of falling out of the closets. Do you see evidence of this in terms of what comes across your desk? Is there a lot of other smart home, connected home type activity going on out there by security researchers? Or
I would say a medium percentage of them were IoT, but not necessarily, you know, disproportionate. But we expect that to change. And IoT vulnerabilities, because they're so prevalent, I think the scope of them has probably been quite documented. There is a multi-stakeholder process that's been going out around in Canada. That's a combination between our CIRA, which is our country level, top level domain, right? So it runs .ca, Internet Society, ISOC, and a government department here where they've identified some of the more serious, you know, repeated security lapses that are happening in IoT devices and documented some instances, not from a ground level, but, you know, just, you know, looking at what's been publicly reported. And they're trying to set up some sort of labeling mechanism that would incentivize better security, as well as some, you know, responsiveness in terms of how to deal with security threats when they're found at IoT. And all of this is just out of recognition that the threat vector for IoT is, you know, it's a combination of both the, you know, the, as you were saying, right, like the ability to open the door, like those types of capabilities are built into IoT.
Yeah. But
there's a much more physical impact. And because there's a lot of companies trying to rush things out the door, there's often less attention to that.
The sausage factory for software in general is not pretty, but the IoT sausage factory is really not pretty. You know, it's sort of,
It starts hitting, like, you know, things that can go boom or can actually.
You guys up there just had an election, and congratulations, by the way.
Thanks.
Were these types of issues, cybersecurity issues, much of a topic of debate or conversation on any of the campaigns?
So obviously there was the election-specific cybersecurity issues that are unavoidably part of the thing. But cybersecurity and privacy, you know, under the broader rubric of privacy, cybersecurity did actually become an election issue here. I would say probably for the first time, I think, in Canada. So most of the major parties had some sort of platform on addressing, you know, privacy and informational security more broadly that did have a cybersecurity component to it. Now, obviously, we're in the post-election era, so we get to see which of those translate into actual outcomes. But the government that we have in place, we got the same government in places before, has, you know, made attempts to address some of these issues in the past, and it having risen to the level of a campaign, a campaign issue. So there's some regulatory kind of proposals that can be put in place that address, you know, privacy, information security, as well as cybersecurity that would get into IoT a bit better, security a bit better, and then some other kind of more broader government-based monitoring initiatives that might be put in place. As well, as I mentioned, the multi-stakeholder process that I was talking about at the outset that's led by ISOC and our top-level domain registrar. There's a government department that was actually also kind of informally involved in moving that along. So, a lot of attention and attempts to see kind of what Canada can contribute to the niche of internet of security, you know, IoT security and cybersecurity in general.
Yeah, there's nowhere to go but up, really. So if you can help us,
that's just absolutely true.
If you guys can help us get up,
that could
not
be more true.
For our listeners, who are out there who are independent security researchers, maybe they're up there in Canada. Advice to them on how to navigate these treacherous waters.
Before you start tooling around, do a little bit of, and I imagine your listeners would have already done this, but I mean, you really take some time to take a look at what the best practices look like, and then, you know, to the best that you can, try to aspire to those, especially when you get to the responsible disclosure bits. Like, I think there it is important to try to, at the very least, you know, approach the company before going live and go through those types of steps. And then, you know, if you run into trouble, come to us and we'll do what we can.
And what I see sometimes is there are you know, and it really depends on the researcher. And actually, in the case that we were talking about, I really don't think this is the case at all. But often there's a competing desire to, you know, kind of cross your T's and dot your I's in terms of responsible disclosure. But there's also a desire to kind of get out there first and be the person disclosing this and kind of getting the glory. And so I've talked to researchers where it's like, well, did you tell the company about it? And it's like, well, I sent them an email like yesterday afternoon, you know, and then I dropped, you know, this morning. You know? And it's like, well... you know, that's not a lot of time for them to respond.
I mean, and the sad, and I know that the assumption for researchers is sometimes, oh, if I found it, you know, maybe somebody else is going to find it soon. But sadly, that's
there's often not the case. Yeah.
Out there, so yeah, be patient and, you know, go through the steps and it'll pay off in the long run. Yeah. And more generally, though, I think it would be good to get security researchers just, you know, cognizant of the, you know, the need to have the safe harbors and bug bounty programs formalized and in place for companies. I think like security researchers end up at companies at some point, and just having that awareness out there, I think, is a useful kind of thing in and of itself.
Tamir Israel, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Tamir Israel is a staff attorney at the Canadian Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic.